Hello, and welcome to The Dirt, a podcast about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past. I'm Anna.
And I'm Amber.
And I'm congested.
Oh, God. I told you you didn't have to eat so fast.
I know. I'm sorry. I was so excited to get to this episode recording time. hey, we're here. We're doing it. Here we go. So, up top, thank you to the folks who have subscribed to the premium feed, which you can do at captivate.fm, and the link will be in the show notes.
Yeah, but this week's episode is going to be a little atypical, because I wrote it. Well, that's not why. But
that's not why.
No, well, no, but since I was writing it, and I've been struggling with finding topics, and mm-hmm. I spent a while hovering over the keyboard while writing this, struggling to phrase the next part. So might as well out with it. Someone who meant a lot to me died, and I'm doing all of that grief stuff that they talk about in your high school health class, which is probably the last time until I talked about it in therapy that anybody had mentioned grief to me. So clearly dealing well. But because of that, I don't want to talk about anybody who is dead or will eventually be dead, and which is a challenge when you're half of a show about archaeology, anthropology, and our shared human past, because it's full of dead people. long-time perceptive listeners of our show might already know that I find comfort in the very, very big picture, where my own lifetime and its sorrows and its joys constitute an almost imperceptibly small pixel. So today, listeners, you are zooming out with me, so we don't have to think about time in minutes or months or years or even millennia, but instead, truly, millions of years, which is also kind of hard to do when you're talking about, like, people, because we haven't been here long enough for me to feel okay about it. But fortunately, our friends over in geology recently had a breaking news story that provided a perfect topic for the occasion. And also, it's fitting that I'm doing this like a few weeks. It will come out a few weeks after I read this because it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So Anna,
our time scale is geologic today.
Yeah. Anna, after much deliberation by the International Union of Geological Sciences Subcommission on Quaternary Stratigraphy. So nice. So almost as long as it took me to get that out, they have been debating the resolution, which seriously was introduced 15 years ago. There has been a vote.
Again, geologic time.
Yeah, which just truly.
Perfect. Perfect.
But with that vote, I regret to inform you that we are not in the Anthropocene.
Wow. Well, dang.
I know. I'm over here writing Anthropocene on all my checks still. But
it takes a while to sort of snap out into the new era. Epic?
Mm. Well, we'll find out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good. Good thinking. We're getting there. So, All right. Okay. People saw this word in the title. They
and went unsubscribe.
No, they saw that, like, around the time that I was doing this, Grimes released a video for the best song off of her album from 4 years ago, Miss Anthropocene. It's not that. It's none of that. I also spent a lot of time just watching old Grimes videos going, oh.
Just like, man.
Really?
That's too bad.
Yeah. Oh.
That's some cool wordplay, though.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So. But let's rewind to the earliest appearance of the term. So the first appearance of Anthropocene occurred in 1951 in science fiction. In the story Star King by Jay Vance, not the Hillbilly Elegy guy.
Oh, okay.
That was published in Galaxy magazine. There is a citation for a fictional journal article.
Sorry. What is that name?
I know. Just read.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I'm taking this from the Oxford English Dictionary.
So. I know, and I also, but, I just needed to know that I was not having a very minor stroke.
I know.
Okay. Well, here is the citation. From A Study of Interclass Accommodations by Ferb Hankbert in Journal of the Anthropocene. Volume, help me out with those.
Oh, 1113.
1113. Is that a goof 'em up of Frank Herbert?
No. This is before that. This is in 1951 that this was published. This is a future. This is a future science name. Remember, so the name Ferb. Do you remember when we talked about do you remember in the episode 100, I think it was, that we need to talk about the future?
I know.
Future, and there was Jim S. Smoot. This is a Jim S. Smoot guy. I love mid-century future names.
It is a mush of Frank Herbert. When did Dune come out?
Stop with the Dune. No, like, okay. It was, I'm Dune-pilled, not you. It's not. No, Frank Herbert just has an extremely, like, mid-century white guy name. This is a play off of Ferb Hankbert.
It is literally an anagram. Okay.
Maybe Jay Vance was... I don't know, but you're caught on the.
Let's go. I know. I'm sorry.
Ferb. But I also like you. Also, elided over something that I really like about like a future journal.
Sorry.
That this is volume 1113 of a journal it's been going for a while. Yeah, such a storied.
But they're still using Roman numerals, so.
Well, yeah. I mean, talk about Dune. We got Jessica. So, you know,
let's not.
You're baiting me into talking about Dune.
I'm not Dune baiting you. I just, my brain likes word puzzles.
So for the next 50 years, the term Anthropocene was thrown around here and there, used to mean different things for different audiences. But in the year 2000 CE, things changed. That year, atmospheric chemist and haver of a normal name, Paul Crutzen, and biologist and also haver of a normal name, Eugene Sturmer, published a punchy little number in the International Geosphere Biosphere Program's Global Change newsletter titled The Anthropocene. So Crutzen and Stormer's essay argues for recognizing the sheer scale of human-made or anthropogenic change on Earth systems. To them, humans are a force on par with geologic processes and cite, in part, the following examples of the degree of impact we've had on the planet. So this was done in 2000. Mm. So in 300 years, the human population had grown to 6 billion. The current estimate as of last week, according to the UN, is about 8 billion. So that's in the last 23 years, really. And the cow population had grown to 1.4 billion. So according to National Beef Wire, the current estimate is closer to 942 million. I don't know.
This is how
far I've gone to avoid talking about, like, individual lives and deaths. I'm going on to,
that's fine. I
hitting
just,
the beef wire. Coming in hot on the beef wire. So the rest of the facts I'll share reflect the time of publication in 2000. A tenfold increase in urbanization over the past century and accelerating use of fossil fuels. Not totally sure how tenfold is assessed there, but sulfur dioxide emissions alone were twice that of all greenhouse gas emissions combined from natural sources. There are several types of greenhouse gases, so that is a bad thing. So 30 to 50% of all land surfaces on Earth had been transformed by human action. More nitrogen was in use in agriculture as fertilizer than in all terrestrial ecosystems. More than half of all accessible freshwater was in use by humans. Species extinction rates in rainforests and wetlands were accelerating, and decimating the mangrove population and those sort of coastal. And quote, finally, mechanized human predation, fisheries, removes more than 25% of the primary production of the oceans in the upwelling regions and 35% in the temperate continental shelf regions, end quote. That is just of straight up fish in the ocean, not like this is the a hatchery or something. So what did Crutzen and Stormer want their colleagues to do with this information in that essay?
Well, let me tell you by reading this quote. Quote, considering these and many other major and still growing impacts of human activities on Earth and atmosphere and at all, including global scales, it seems to us more than appropriate to emphasize the central role of mankind in geology and ecology by proposing to use the term Anthropocene for the current geological epoch. The impacts of current human activities will continue over long periods.
Yeah, so that's what they want you to do with it. Call it by its name.
Sure. Okay, sure. That makes sense. Let's center ourselves.
What do you mean? What do you mean? We could talk this
no,
out.
No, I just... No, it's... No, it's just... It seems like... There could have been other things to do with this information.
But I mean, these are two geological scientists speaking to geological scientists.
Yes, I do realize that. And I think I've been thinking a lot about sort of science outreach lately. Oh.
Well, this is science in reach.
Yeah. I think that's why I was just sort of like, oh.
No, that newsletter was like for the boys.
Okay, let's keep going.
But if we think about when human action kicked off the processes Crutzen and Stormer highlighted, how far back do we push it before it becomes absurd? Right. So do we push it to the Industrial Revolution? Do we push it to the so-called Columbian Exchange with the, because it wasn't...
You get smallpox. You get your stuff.
Slavery.
Yeah.
And bananas. Yes. Is it the Columbian Exchange with the staggering effects it caused for land and labor exploitation? Do we push it back to the also so-called Neolithic Revolution with its development of agriculture and animal domestication? Any of those? Mm-hmm. So depending on how far back we pedal, defining the Anthropocene or the Anthropocene would... It's, it's
yeah,
a dumb language. You can say it how you
want. But yeah.
Defining the Anthropocene would break it out of or perhaps entirely encompass the Holocene, which means the recent whole, like everything recent is what it means. And that's the epoch we currently occupy. That includes everything since the last glacial maximum around 12,000 years ago, including the Bon Iver song, which I also listen to. And I was just like,
okay,
I just really, it really, I went through the teens, the 20 teens. I just relived them all. For their part, Crutzen and Stormer recommended the late 18th century CE, saying, quote, we chose this date because during the past two centuries, the global effects of human activities have become clearly noticeable. This is the period when data retrieved from glacial ice cores show the beginning of growth in the atmospheric concentrations of several greenhouse gases. Such a starting date also coincides with James Watt's invention of the steam engine in 1784. At that time, biotic assemblages in most lakes began to show large changes, end quote.
The Anthropocene.
Okay. However, they do concede that some might argue for the Anthropocene to include the entire Holocene. But Anna, I hear our listeners crying out, what even is a scene?
I got you, listeners, to the dictionary, specifically the OED. Again,
the big one, yeah.
Quote, forming adjectives designating epochs and strata of the tertiary and quaternary periods and nouns denoting such epochs. End quote. What? Okay. This all comes down to how geological time is defined. Right now, we are in the Holocene epoch of the quaternary period of the Cenozoic era of the Phanerozoic eon. So that's moving like up in time scale, moving bigger, right?
Well, read the next line.
Oh, okay. Yep. Moving from epoch to period to era reduces specificity and increases similarity. It's similar to how when we move from species to genus to family, the funnel widens for who's included.
Very well put. Does that make sense?
That was really well.
Thank you. Doing outreach.
None of this inreach.
Oh, I've done that. There. That's the set. That's next week.
That's why we're doing this. The Holocene started about 12,000 years ago. The Quaternary period started around 2.588 million years ago. The Cenozoic era started around 66 million years ago. And the Phanerozoic eon started 541 million years ago. Each division represents a shift in how the Earth as a system functions, as expressed through changes in its life forms. We've included in the show notes a link to a handy chart of the current as of 2012, but again, geological timescale.
But that geological is the current one.
Yeah, I know. But geology is not going to change much in the past 12 years. In the Geological Society of America's Geologic Timescale V4.0. I'm going to have that for you.
Yeah.
So if the Anthropocene were passed as a new epoch, we would be in the Anthropocene epoch of the Quaternary period of the Cenozoic era. We'd be in a new species of time. While the International Union of Geological Scientists wrestled with whether it is meaningful for their purposes, the term Anthropocene accumulated value across a variety of natural and social sciences over the years.
And that includes anthropology in a big way. After all, it is the study of the root cause of the impacts identified by Crutzen and Sturmer and other researchers who've continued this work in the quarter century since. Mm-hmm. Put away your emails, folks. You got to listen to the end of this one.
Just wait.
Hold on. I'm getting somewhere.
Hold on.
Let's look at some of the commonly proposed start dates for the Anthropocene and consider the merits of each argument and see what they tell us about the past and maybe even science itself.
Ah.
Yeah. So first up, we have the earliest contender, the point at which humans first transformed the Earth through intentional land use. In 2019, a survey was conducted, in which, according to the authors, quote, we asked over 1,300 archaeologists from around the world to contribute their knowledge on how ancient people used the land in 146 regions spanning all continents except Antarctica from 10,000 years ago right up to 1850. More than 250 responded.
Woof.
Representing the largest expert archaeology.
I know, right?
In reach. Representing the largest expert archaeology crowdsourcing project ever undertaken, though some prior projects have worked with amateur contributions, end quote. We call those citizen scientists. So what that survey yielded, and it's all published and visualized in quite pretty maps and things.
Oh, that's nice.
So what they found out was surprising. So 42% of reviewed regions, and of course there was some over-representation. No, I guess you can't over-represent something. Under-representation of some regions just from the amount of work that had been done or, I'm sure there are other factors like the affecting participation here. But of the reviewed regions, so they got data for all of them, the 42% had some form of agriculture by 6,000 years ago. And that is that is surprising, given that it was thought that there wasn't agriculture that early in so many places. So they say, quote, onset of agriculture was earlier and more widespread than suggested in the most common global reconstruction of land use history, the History Database of the Global Environment, end quote. And that matters because that's what's used by climate scientists in estimates of future climate change. So they might be underestimating climate effects associated with land use because they assumed that there was less agriculture later. So they were underestimating huge parts of the world. And so this also speaks to the importance of collaboration among disciplines. Something else that was borne out in this is that hunting and foraging generally was replaced by pastoralism and agriculture in most places, but there were exceptions, reversals, and coexistence of the two modes.
Represented. Makes total sense.
Yeah, of course. Which also complicates the model that is used by climate scientists. The authors conclude that, here we go, impacts started appearing locally 10 to 8,000 years ago. But by 3,000 years ago, the environment had been altered by human behavior on a global scale. So instead of like the late 18th century, when we started to see these changes, though, you know, we see the lake biota reflecting large scale changes, which can be, you know, forgiven if that's the focus, because Stormer was a like lake biologist.
But right, what you know,
we have local like human like truly changing a system.
It depends what kind of changes you're looking for, right?
We're looking
and sort of what scale.
Well, we're looking at like this, the where it starts to become a geological change, like a system change, like the way the system works, not just like here's some stuff or like, but just sort of it is affecting the climate.
Okay. So yes. Okay. So the climate record that is preserved in geological strata.
Yeah, but there are other things that factor into this, not just like the looking at how the system worked. And one of the easiest proxies for that is the kind of the stuff in the strata. But so was it 3,000 years ago or was it more recent than that?
Well, if we fast forward way, way, way forward, we have the late 18th century CE originally proposed by Crittson and Stormer. I did Stormer, and then I couldn't get my vowels back in order. This correlates with the invention of the steam engine, which relied upon coal burning and started the trend towards mechanization and its steadily increasing dependence on fossil fuels. This phenomenon and the material record of its expressions is the subject of a newer field of archaeology that distinguishes itself from historical archaeology, industrial archaeology. Neat. In a chapter from the Oxford Handbook of Industrial Archaeology, Marilyn Palmer provides a definition of this distinct field, writing, quote, "It is now generally accepted that industrial archaeology is the systematic study of standing as well as subsurface structures, artifacts, and residues of the classic period of industrialization from the 18th to the 20th centuries. It must be recognized, firstly, that industrialization in this sense began earlier in some industries than others, and that therefore an interpretation of a particular site or industry may need to go back to the 17th century or earlier." Yeah, that makes sense. "Secondly, it is clear that the domestic or home-based method of production continued to coexist with factory production, albeit with many changes in the lifestyle of the workforce. The purpose of industrial archaeology, then, is to make use of a multidisciplinary approach involving site, landscape, and building survey, photography, excavation, the study of artifacts, documentary research, and oral history to study, interpret, and in some cases preserve the physical evidence of the vast social and economic changes which have overtaken society in the past 250 years or so. It is generally concerned with the evidence for people at work, and so defines a type of human activity rather than a type of site, since work, even after the so-called Industrial Revolution, could be based in domestic as well as non-domestic locations." Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's That's a really nice, comprehensive, but it's neat.
Yeah,
it's a neatly stated.
Yeah, that's why I just quoted it, because I'm like, well, I'm not gonna do it better than you did.
Can't say it any. Yeah, yeah. Can't say it any better. Palmer also points out that another hallmark of industrial archaeology is its opportunities for engaging the present through oral histories of residents and industrial workers, as well as the phenomenon of industrial reuse and the persistence of industrial equipment and architecture in contemporary landscapes.
Do you know what we're talking about there? You think of industrial reuse. Is that mean anything to you?
I can think of reuse of industrial spaces. Like, I'm thinking of like old mill factories being repurposed for apartments, but I don't know that that's...
Yeah, that's really what a lot of it is. Or the examples that I can think of, because this has come up in my work, having things like, a lot of them are like, can we turn these into lofts? Or like, can we turn this into a venue? Somebody that I know recently got married at the Felt Factory, which terrifying, but I guess was a beautiful ceremony. But
they wanted everyone to know how they felt.
But yeah, there are things that where it's like, this is a vibey venue, but there's also stuff like prominent example of industrial reuse is the High Line in New York City. The High Line is the High Line was an elevated rail system, an L train, and that was one of the earliest incarnations of public transit in New York. But it stopped being used because they built a subway system that was able to do it, and it just fell out of use. And so it was just this big chunk of infrastructure kind of cutting through one of the like densest parts of the city. And so what they did was they got some landscape architects. We got an architectural firm to come in and zhuzh it up. And it's now like an elevated park. And so it's a green space. And so that's why there's a lot of, nice. There are some quite noble ideas, like for uses for industrial reuse. Fairmount Park in, Philadelphia is, I think could be technically considered an industrial reuse space because it used to be the waterworks. The other thing about the High Line is that there's a hotel, like I think the Standard, that like looks out on it, and they had an entire ad campaign that was like for exhibitionists to be like, come stay here and people can see in the windows. they leaned into it, which is odd.
We're not here to yuck any yums.
Another one in New York, I'm thinking of New York ones for a specific reason because I focused on it. But the TWA Hotel out at JFK is the old TWA Airlines terminal that they converted into a chic little hotel. So it's the they've maintained at like elements of the original terminal and like aesthetics and things like that. But it's a way to repurpose the space in a way that isn't raising a structure and thus like eliminating, its presence in the landscape. So it's it's also like a cool way to, kind of honor it can be done in a way that kind of honors the pasts of spaces, especially in like urban areas, and as a way to not forget like the industry, because a lot of times like industry moves. There's a lot of histories of sort of post-industrial spaces and places in our country and in others, that it's a way to remember the lives of a city. That's sort of part of what industrial reuse is. It's not
that totally makes sense.
That place in Berkeley where you go and you can get like a door, where it's just the,
yeah, but it's not all Pinterest.
Well, no. I'm talking about, do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I haven't spent a lot of time. I've been to Berkeley like once.
I forget. There's a place in, South Berkeley that I cannot remember the name of.
That's okay. They're not sponsoring this.
Urban ore is what it's called.
Like they're mining the city.
And so it's like an industrial, it's like a creative reuse space. And so it's like basically it's kind of like a flea markety space. No, it's not a flea market. It's just like a secondhand store for like
salvage yard.
Yeah. It's like a secondhand store for like elements. And so you can get like
3 acres of recycled goods. Wow.
It's like parts of buildings and you can get a door and you can like get doors to put in your doors. And you can get I've gotten furniture there. I've gotten like
cool
gardening stuff.
Is cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So like those sorts of spaces. I'm not talking about that. The thing I brought up, I'm not talking about.
No, I really like this because, you know, one of the things that we try to bring to our episodes is the idea of the importance of just the average human life and that including the stories of average human lives is a way to emphasize and reiterate that there's no wrong way to be a human. There's no wrong way to move through the world. And so, yeah, it is useful in that respect, I think, to have this sort of way of preserving what is sort of an ephemeral lifestyle, if you sort of think about it on the timescales that we're, if you think about the timescales that we're thinking about, everything is ephemeral, but just sort of, it is a category of ways of living that is less and less represented in the US, at least.
Ways of living, but also like
ways of surviving.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, an example, I can think of an extremely ephemeral example also, because on the side of this apartment building, somebody graffitied a pig. And also Coney 2012. And I referred to that place as the Coney Pig Building for a while. This was in 2012. But it's a building down near Jack London Square in Oakland, which is like a warehouse district because it's on the port. And there was a cookie factory that had been rehabbed and like reused into lofts, naturally. It was 2012.
I wonder if they smelled as good as I hope a cookie factory would.
But it used to. And so like that is having that space that used to be a cookie factory that would smell like cookies. There are people who have sort of sense memories of this space.
Of living there?
And so I'm sure, not by living there. They didn't live there. They made cookies there. So I was saying like the cookie went like, so that the talking about folding in those like oral histories and recent time and memory. This is a way that I'm sure no one involved from sort of the acquisition of the building to the person doing the Coney Pig graffito was like thinking of this, but there is something there. There's like a power there and a value there of being able to say like, oh yeah, like you could smell like this place that you think that you would think was like, oh, it's very grubby and very like, it's just like a lot of, it's like very warehousey. So it's dusty, it's dirty, it's kind of mucky from the ships and all this stuff. And it's like squished fruit from the produce section, like further up the block. But there also would have been this like very like delightful and sweet
sugary vanilla
scent of cookies. And so it's a way that gives another layer of complexity to our perception of the past. But that's not at all what this episode is about. But
I was just thinking about, well, it's rare that you can give additional sensory information to an account of the past like
yeah.
that.
Yeah, and it's evocative.
Yeah. And equally evocative are things like ghost building, like advertisements and labels, where it's a building that used to be something and it had a big painted part of its facade that is sort of only partially visible now. Like that's
there's a place
compelling.
Back home like that. I won't that that used to be a department store when the town was like a railroad town, but where like it was fed by the railroad, so it was like it had a pretty stable economy at that time. And then I remember being in that building when it sort of, the last generation that ran the department store had sort of scaled it back to the point that it eventually closed. But I remember being in that space. And then it lay vacant for a long time, as many buildings in that town did, because there were there was no business and there was no buyers because of various material forces. But it has in recent years been rehabilitated and like retrofitted, and it's now affordable and accessible housing. And it's this very cool apartment building that is like, you know, it's not like fancy lofts like in many places that they become like the places that people who would have worked there could never have dreamed of living in later. But it's now, but that they do have that, the name of the business, it's sort of like a kind of quirky old timey name. The name of the business is still on the side, and they conserved the exterior signage of like what they sell and what they do, and like it, so it's a it's a way to something
more
than 100 years ago.
Well, we should revisit industrial archaeology another time and give it the attention it deserves and not wander down three different garden paths. But after all, we are this episode looking for clues in the geological record, not the archaeological record. And boy, are there plenty. According to a 2016 study published in Nature and adapted for non-specialist audiences in The Conversation, it's Outreach. And both of those are available in our show notes. Outreachception. The effects of the Industrial Revolution on the climate were almost immediate. The first areas to exhibit signs of global warming were the tropical oceans and the Arctic in the 1830s. By the 1850s, the northern hemisphere regions of Europe, North America, and Asia were warming as well. Almost a half century later, the southern hemisphere began to show signs of warming. Today, the southward creep continues into, but doesn't fully encompass, Antarctica, thanks to the southern ocean, insulating it from warmer waters. So that 2016 study focused on a 500-year record of coral skeletons, ice cores, tree rings, cave deposits, and ocean and lake sediment layers. All of those form slowly and capture climate data as they grow. The depth of time included in the record provided a baseline of variability to help contextualize what's natural fluctuation versus what's anthropogenic, caused by human activity. Volcanic activity in the 19th century had generated a cooling trend for global temperatures, which was neutralized and eventually reversed, by the activity of the Industrial Revolution. Climate skeptics love to invoke natural fluctuations, but studies such as these are both aware of and account for such variability, like good science should. The other thing about this study, the authors point out, is that this early start to industrialization-induced climate impact means that even the most ambitious climate policies will be insufficient. The baseline for measuring climate change among international governments and UN types is relative to data from the latter half of the 19th century, when thermometer-based record-keeping began. By then, most of the human-inhabited world was already heating up. So, did we enter the Anthropocene 200 years ago, or even more recent than that?
Well, you'll just have to tune in for our next episode to find out. But please do, because I'm going to make some really good points in it.
I have no doubt. Well, oh, right, I have to end the episode. Yeah, so stay tuned, and that episode will be coming out on the main feed. Keep your ears peeled. Thanks for listening, everybody. We love you.
Talk at you soon.
Bye.
Goodbye.